hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias. I am the color red in a world of black and white. Now time for us to hoop it up forever.
Wow. Did not have this on the bingo card, though I never have your intros on the bingo card. So, you know, we just roll with the punches. Recording early on a Tuesday morning, earlier than usual on a Tuesday morning. So, you know, I'm trying to get.
So we have the club going up on a Tuesday.
Ain't no way. I'll allow it. That's a good shot. We'll let you rock. But no, recording early on a Tuesday. I have some driving to do. I'm going to try to hit the Dream Mercury game, which matters a lot more than I thought it was going to heading into the weekend slate of games. But we will get some Atlanta thoughts in soon. Let's just say soon. We'll start with some news nuggets on the NBA side first. The Hornets and PJ Washington, we've been monitoring what's going on with PJ pretty much all offseason. As one of the premier restricted free agents that felt like they could change hands, but as the early movement of free agency happened, it seemed pretty clear, like, oh, this is just going to be a PJ / Charlotte negotiation. Let's see where that lands. Are they going to come to some kind of deal? Is it just going to be the one-year qualifying offer and you test the market next year? Didn't know. Got the report over the weekend. PJ Washington and the Hornets agreeing to a 3-year, $48 million contract. So about 16 per. Steve, how did you feel about the deal when the news came out?
Finally, it happened. Finally, it got done. I'm sure all parties involved can breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief. Hornets, no, they still have PJ Washington in their core. Hornet fans, no, he's still going to be a piece there. Not just going to lose him for nothing. And PJ Washington can have a level of security. As far as, okay, I know I'm getting this for at least this amount of time. The battle for the 1 year, I can understand if you looked at the market this year and maybe some uncertainty next year, and it was like, okay, maybe I could get more, but let's go ahead and get this done, and we could see what happens on the next runaround. I'm interested in how like teams try and build their rosters and what past players try and go with. As this salary cap explodes and everything starts to raise up, got to spend money. So are you going to go short term, try and get a bigger payday? Are you going to take, you know, maybe more years knowing what you're going to get? It's going to be interesting, but I think it's a plus for PJ Washington. That usually is the market for you are of this height and can do things. So I'm good with it, especially coming off the year he had. I want to see what the next step is for him, but I think it's important for Charlotte to keep developing him because he had a pretty good year last year.
He did indeed, highlighted by a nice little 40 ball against OKC, top 10 ranked defense at the time of the scoring burst. Just want to throw that out there quickly. But
we're starting with this already?
I'm just saying, PJ Washington can get some buckets. He could do a little bit of everything. I'm a big fan of what PJ Washington brings to the basketball court, both sides of the floor. For me, like this feels like more good on Charlotte than good on PJ. And I say that because there were the early rumblings of PJ wanting 20 plus mil a year. And frankly, I think he's worth that. Like if we had day one or day two of free agency and you tell me PJ Washington signed for 4 for $84 or something like that, I don't blink at that. I think he is that good. I think he is that versatile and there is room for more exploration with him offensively in particular. And so, like, within that very specific lens, if you tell me, oh, PJ's getting 16 a year for the next 3 years, that just feels like good work for Charlotte. That also brings me to restricted free agency just kind of stinks. And as we kind of talked about with a mailbag question, like, just the state of free agency in general, that landscape seems to be changing with the new CBA and just where everyone is cap-wise right now. And I think PJ felt the crunch a little bit, but obviously it's still a positive for him to lock in this amount of money because that's not shades to sneeze at. 16 mil is a lot of money. And it is nice for him to get that level of security. And I think on the other side, going back to Charlotte, like if they do want to go any kind of different direction in their front court, like that PJ deal is very movable if they want to look at something like that. And I would imagine contenders, as PJ was linked to a couple of them this past season, as he didn't get the extension heading into the offseason. That's still a deal that contenders can look at and be like, okay, nah, he could be our final piece to unlock some lineup versatility, just to unlock some versatility in general. And so I would keep an eye on that moving forward, especially over, you know, next year and a half or so. But yeah, like I didn't expect that to be the news break that I got, or news break that I saw rather. But, you know, props to PJ, props to the Hornets, they got it done. Now I'm just excited to see what comes next.
No, I hear you there. And it's interesting because you look, I think what Harrison Barnes got 18 per, Rui got about 17 per. So is that just going to be the thing? And then we go up a little bit from there, or is that also going to go? But you're right.
Yeah, just, and again, like I may be in the minority of this, but I think PJ's better than both of those guys. And so if you're able to get him at a lower number, like again, just from the team perspective, trying to balance your books and stuff like that, like that's really good work. I want to see what PJ's next contract looks like. I think, and I guess to bounce off of that, I'll ask you a question based on one of your earlier comments. What do you think the next step should be for him? Like what area of game do you want to see him explore with or improve on? Or what are you kind of eyeing for PJ?
For me, defense and consistency offensively, production-wise. Especially, I think the tricky part with PJ is his talent has grown. Charlotte's context has changed a little bit. So I want to see what he looks like with LaMelo back. And I want to see what he looks like as the Hornets get better. Mm-hmm. What's the usage going to look like? Is it going to be less of a role? Is he going to have to compact it a little bit? So that's kind of where I'm at. It's not necessarily PJ's fault. It's more just like, okay, what's the ceiling of this? Like, is this going to be a team where, okay, you're playing well, we will put you in the John Collins zone and switch everything, and now what's your impact? More is more the versatility going to pop? Will he be used in different ways? So I'm just kind of trying to see what the next step is for him and the Hornets. I think they can both grow together. At the same time, sometimes you pop, your team gets better, your role lessens, it looks a little different.
Okay, that makes sense. I guess on that front, and then we can move. Like, I guess I'm curious to see just what his minute allocation is going to be like this year between the 4 and the 5. Because I think just with what Charlotte's center room was last year, especially before like Mark Williams just got the starting job and kind of solidified that the back half of the year, backup center was a little bit of a question mark. And I think now that you know that Mark is going to be your center, backup five still remains at least a little bit of a question mark for Charlotte. And so is he still going to be able to get those minutes? And to your point about defensive growth, can he continue to grow as someone at the five? Will that still remain like a switch all? Can he act as a primary rim protector? And if so, like, what does that really unlock for Charlotte moving forward in terms of lineup versatility? So that's probably the big thing defensively. Offensively, like, the pick and roll reps intrigued me. Continued growth against switches, post-ups, especially if he's going to be playing more four, you know, to your John Collins point about getting seen more switches and stuff. If he's able to continue to maintain those advantages, I think that'd be pretty beneficial for him and the team. So there's your Charlotte Hornet talk on the podcast. We had to do it. On the W front, just a quick injury note for the Atlanta Dream. And again, we have some Dream conversation to have a little bit later in the pod. But Nia Coffey is out for the season with the hand injury. Averaged 7 points, 5 boards, stayed under 2 dimes per game this season. Also a little bit over a steal. Really, really good defensive season for Nia Coffey this year. Under the radar. Should be or should have been at least an all defense consideration. It is a very tight forward group this year. So understandable if she does not make it or would not make it for you, but she was having that caliber of a season. So that kind of stinks. I do think, I guess for Atlanta overall, if they were going to see an injury anywhere, like front court seems to be the place where they could quote unquote afford it just because of the level of depth that they have up there. Monique Billings has stepped into the starting role from there. In particular, we're seeing more Naz Hillman, who gave some good minutes last year as well. But it does still stink to lose Nia. And that defensive versatility and also just the improving shot. Like, shot very well from deep, shot 40% from three this year on moderate volume. So I hope she gets better. Did you have any Nia Coffey thoughts?
No, I think you nailed it. And I know we're about to talk the Dream anyway, so.
Fair enough. Well, before we get to the Dream, let's get into the FIBA World Cup to, before we even dig into the actual basketball, have you been following the world champion versus whatever conversation that's perked up?
No, I don't care.
Okay.
I don't care. I want every single one of you to know there are so many beautiful things in life to enjoy, and you get one chance of this journey, and we're having this argument. Hey, that man had that thought in his head, and he picked that moment to say it because, yeah, he did that. And do you not know basketball players? Yes. What's the level of pride and ego that they have? So they all banded together and clapped back.
That
even Denzel Valentine had something to say.
He ain't.
Yeah. So no. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care.
That concludes World Champion Gate here at the Dunker Spot. Anyway, let's talk some FIBA World Cup. We will start with Team USA. Couple of games off the ground. Couple of big wins so far. Beat New Zealand 99-71 in their opener. And then they beat Greece 109-81 in the second game. They are playing Jordan, I believe, tomorrow morning. That is the Ronde Hollis Jefferson Bryant team, I suppose, at this rate. We can talk a little bit about that later. But through two games, Steve, what have been your initial impressions of this Team USA squad?
Well, I mean, it builds off what we talked about in the lead up to the World Cup. Two games played out similarly to a degree. The biggest thing I want people to know is to take a look at the philosophy for Team USA. There's a lot of rotation talk. There's a lot of Halliburton talk, Reeves talk. Take a look at the bigger picture. And what Team USA is trying to do is maximize this roster, maximize this versatility, get the most out of their guys in a limited way. The lineups are fire and ice. And then you end up combining them as the game goes on. The better that first unit ends up playing, the better it will look in totality. This Team USA is trying to use their depth to wear teams down over the course of a game. It's not a bunch of activity and ball denials and forcing turnovers. No, we're going to be active on defense, but you have to beat us over and over and over again. And offensively, you have to deal with our ability to shoot, do drive, to make plays for each other. We can post, we got scores, and then the second unit plays with a ton of pace, ton of tempo. So you have to deal with all of that over the course of the game. We saw both in the New Zealand matchup and in the Greece matchup, over time, as Team USA responded and settled in, it got tough for both of those teams. The defense didn't look as strong for New Zealand and Greece. The offense got a little bit more stagnant because you got to keep creating those plays. And part of the reality is, you, like, my mind goes back to the Greece game. I want to say, what, Thomas Walkup hit like four runners in the first corner. Are you going to build the boat on that? That's not what you do. That's not exactly what you do. So Team USA hasn't hit that challenge of a team that is able to do what they do over and over again, like Germany did or like Spain did in the buildup. It gets tough when Team USA doesn't cooperate. We saw in the New Zealand game, the turnovers really hurt them because Team USA was getting stops. It wasn't turning into anything. So once they clean that up, that's good. There's just some things this team can't afford. If you're going to be more solid defensively, the base can't get hit. So we see the plays where Jaren Jackson Jr. gets hit in a drop, or even with the smaller unit against Greece, they're giving up penetration and they're giving up drive and kick. Now, okay, y'all can't do that. I've been impressed with Team USA's response to a degree. And then I kind of just want to just go back to like the first unit, right? Because there's a lot of chatter about Brandon Ingram and Jalen Brunson. I think the first unit, the idea of the first unit just needs to be matched with the execution. I go back to the first play against Greece. It's traditionally a post up for Jaren Jackson Jr. He doesn't necessarily draw help. Then help comes. He kicks it to Brandon Ingram. Brandon Ingram has a decision to make. Anthony Edwards is right next to him. He can swing it, or he can drive the closeout and play. He goes to drive the closeout. They call a travel, which I felt bad for the first unit because I feel like their best possessions ended up in a travel trying to drive and kick.
Yes.
But it's those little spots where they're trying to find their way as far as which spots do I take this shot? Do I drive? They're trying to make quick decisions. They need to make quick decisions. But if you choose wrong, tough. And like, I sympathize with them because teams are, they're showing different defenses. So you're getting different looks. You might draw a bunch of help. And when that first unit sees help, it looks tremendous. Promise you. When they don't, you start to see the buffer. You start to see him think. You start to see the tempo slow down. You see Jalen Brunson take an extra dribble. B.I. takes an extra dribble. Anthony Edwards says, fine, I'll do it.
Have no fear.
So there's kind of that balance. And I think it looks different when one of those guys has it going, because now it's established. Okay, go ahead. You start to play. You start to cook. But I think they're finding a way. What are your thoughts on that first unit?
I think for me, it's trying to establish the hierarchy. And I think in the lead up to this, we talked about like Anthony Edwards just kind of establishing, okay, I am that guy, for better or for worse. And you made, you know, great commentary on, you have to take some of these shots. You have to live with some of these shots to get the benefit of what he can do for you and how he can take over. But I thought heading in, like at the very least, we know it's starting with Ant. And I guess from there, it's just trying to figure out, okay, who's, it felt like heading in, Anthony Edwards is going to be one. And like Mikal Bridges is going to be four. And like, that's kind of all I knew heading in. Sometimes, you know, Jaren's getting the opening touch, but sometimes Jaren's two, sometimes he's five. Sometimes Jalen Brunson's two. If he doesn't have it going, he's still dribbling a bunch, but now he's sliding to five, or he's three. Brandon Ingram feels like he just kind of float between three through five in the hierarchy. And I think that's been part of his adjustment period. And he recently spoke about, like, you know, the team is winning, but he's kind of frustrated trying to find his way. And I think that's natural, and I think that's fair. And I don't think too much should have been taken into that. Like, yeah, he's really good. He's playing more off ball with the team that, I mean, these aren't the Pelicans, so it's not like he's played with all these guys before. Like, yeah, it's going to be an adjustment period. Yeah, that's just kind of how basketball works sometimes. You got to find your way. But I guess those are the kind of kinks that I'm trying to figure out. And I think we will see less buffering overall in the half court with those guys as they continue to sort through that and know what the driving pockets are, who they're kicking to, what those guys are going to do, and knowing how to play off of that and how to relocate off of that and all that good stuff. And to your point, like, we've seen that in pockets with the starting unit. Like, Jalen Brunson, I feel like, you know, to his standard anyway, struggled against New Zealand and perked up early against Greece. And so, like, even seeing that, like, okay, the gears are turning here. I think ultimately they're going to be fine. And your overarching thing was very much correct. Like, even if they're sorting through that, it's not like New Zealand got off to the good start in the first quarter, but it wasn't like they were blowing Team USA out. Greece was hanging tough in the first quarter, but it's not like they were blowing Team USA out. And then you still have to deal with that second wave, in which, again, I'm just having a ton of fun watching the second unit, but it's Tyrese Halliburton sprinkling in drives, quick shots, quick passes, just generally pushing the pace. Austin Reeves making very quick decisions. And everyone's just kind of flowing from there. Cam Johnson fitting in. They are so tough to deal with on their own because that second unit is just very talented. But in conjunction with, even if Team USA's offense isn't working to full capacity, you're still taking these bumps in the chest from Jalen Brunson on some of these probes and these post-ups. You're still having to deal with the explosiveness of Anthony Edwards, even if he isn't making the shots yet. You still have to account for Brandon Ingram. Jaren Jackson Jr., opening post-touch, but also just generally more aggressive offensively. You still have to deal with him, and then you have to navigate him on the other end as well. Like, it's so physically and mentally taxing to deal with that starting group, even when they aren't playing up to par by their standards. And then the second unit comes in playing 100 miles per hour. And if you slip at all, they attack gaps like this. It is a quick catch and shoot. Oh no, we messed up. That's a wide open corner three. We try to scramble. It's a quick closeout attack. They're relocating behind there. They're driving second side. They're going for a third time if they have to. And you get to the midway point of the third quarter or something, it's like, what do we do with all of this? And by the time the third quarter hits, now, oh, Anthony Edwards has now found his rhythm. Or Brandon Ingram has found a pocket. Or Jaren is now just cooking all of a sudden. Oh, here's another Mikal Bridges drive in transition to get some free throws. And it's like, well, shoot, now we ain't got that figured out either. And this is where the second halves have been so stark in two games. And again, we'll see what the Jordan game looks like tomorrow morning, but it's been kind of fun to sort through that. On the, like, Brandon Ingram / Jalen Brunson front, I'll preface with saying I don't think a lineup change needs to happen regardless. I do wonder, in terms of the like tenor of the conversation with Team USA and the starting unit and some of the flow stuff that we've seen so far, I wonder if the conversation should have been more towards like the Brandon Ingram starting slot versus the Tyrese Halliburton starting slot, if that makes sense. Because it feels like it's more so, okay, is Brunson playing well or not? And with Brandon Ingram, it's, hey, that feels like more of the fit issue, quote unquote, than Brunson. I think with Brunson has it, this is very clear. Ingram feels more like the square peg and round hole of the starting lineup. And I wonder, again, I'm not advocating for a starting job, but like just in terms of the conversation, should it have been more, hey, should they start Cam to get more spacing and quicker decision-making and let Brandon Ingram cook with the second group versus let's get Tyrese in instead of Jalen?
You know, here's my thing, and this is the point I want to make as everyone does the rotation talk. Whenever you do a lineup change, whatever you don't like about the first unit, parts of that are going to stick. And whatever you do like about the second unit, parts of that are going to go away. But yes, in theory, Brandon Ingram with that second unit probably allows him more of the freedom to do Brandon Ingram things. The issue is that second unit now becomes Brandon Ingram doing Brandon Ingram things more than what it is right now. Do you want to make that trade? Do you want to make that trade-off? I think for with BI, it's a scenario where, and it's just, it's more, it's team-wide as well, to where they're trying to figure out their gaps and their understanding and their sets and their tempo, understanding, okay, we're running this stagger. That might be my touch. Can I set up and fly off this screen and get a touch out of it? That pick and roll comes back to me on the second side handoff. That might be my touch. Do I know that's my touch? Can I see that? So now we can play out of that. It's just, that's an understanding part that they're going to have to grow into. I think for me with BI in particular, and even just widening it out, it's hard sometimes to understand the assignment, understand the role. The theory of that starting lineup is it has a ton of versatility. You can run pick and roll with all of them. You can run them all off screens. You can run them off handoffs. They can hit shots. They can drive and kick. It's a little trickier to do some of the things when you know that role is going to be compacted, especially if you're used to having the touches, right? It's easier to make the playmaking when you know, okay, I'm going to get the next play or the next set's going to come back to me or I'm going to get it again. There might be two or three possessions where you don't touch it. You just space. That's a little different. So now it's taking your package that brought you to Team USA and suppressing it into a more compact space. And the irony is some of the players that are having quote unquote the most success, they're used to that.
Yeah.
Mikal Bridges, he just went back. Okay, cool. It's like Phoenix again. Yeah. Tyrese was like, oh, I get to go out there and play Austin Reeves. Yep, this is what I do. Josh Hart, this is what I do. Bobby Portis, this is what I do.
Yeah.
So now it's just, can those guys find their rhythm, find their timing? It's just, to me, it's just learning how to start the car. You know what I mean? Warming up the car or cooling it down. It's summer. If they can do that and time it up well, they're going to be good. If not, you're going to burn yourself on the seatbelt and it's going to be tough. But I feel like Brandon Ingram's time is coming. He just has to be able to sit with it a little bit. I think he'll be better off for this experience because in theory, for the Pelicans to be great, it's going to take more than just him. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I feel like it's an opportunity touch thing. He's just got to find his rhythm. That's all. I think he's just got to find his rhythm, pick his spots, and he'll be all right.
Okay, I got you. Like, I'm not pressing the big red button on Brandon Ingram. I don't think anyone should be pressing the big red button because ultimately, as reductive as this is, this Team USA team is just really freaking good. And even if this is... Even if this becomes just Brandon Ingram for the tournament and it's just an average or subpar showing for him throughout this tournament, Team USA still just has enough to win. They have enough options. They have enough versatility. They have enough depth. It just may not matter in the grand scheme of things. I do think it's an interesting conversation to have as you zoom out to like the Pelicans and like what or who Brandon Ingram is within like a team building context and what the best utilization of him is and stuff. But like, even then, like, I don't know how many, like how much of that conversation you can have in earnest within this context, considering team just got together. It's a whole lot of talent that he hasn't played with before. Like it's just a natural weird space for everyone as they're trying to figure it out. And so I don't know, but it's fun to think about it. I will say quickly on the second unit, cause I mentioned Austin Reeves, mentioned Tyrese.
You better not say Paolo.
I was absolutely about to say Paolo Banchero.
Man.
I'm sorry to disappoint. I'll go short so you can sing the praises of.
Nah, I did it last week.
Hey, man, I'm just saying. Well, then I'm going to bounce off of your point from last week and say Paolo is hooping on both ends of the floor. I've enjoyed the defense from Paolo. And that's not something I anticipated saying heading into the tournament. He did show some interesting flashes in Orlando. Like, I still wouldn't have called him, like, a net positive as a defender. Most rookies aren't, so it's not a big deal. But he's really holding serve at the five. It is not just, like, switchable stuff. Like, he's been in a drop sometimes, and he is navigating that space well and contesting without fouling, cleaning the glass. And if he's the one cleaning the glass, he can also just bring it up if he wants to. It's just been a really fun dynamic with him at the five. I didn't anticipate his defense perking up to this degree. Also didn't anticipate, like, Tyrese's defense perking up to this degree either. Like, he's just been firmly good defensively throughout this entire process. And so that's been interesting to me. But yeah, man, 54 second unit points in the first game and then 60 in the second game. That second unit is cooking.
To bounce off your point about Paolo, the biggest thing is the little things that he's doing defensively. It's one thing to play the five and switch and work to contain in front. As you said, he's sometimes in a drop, but the rotations he's making, the effort he's giving, the rim protection he's giving, the screens he's setting, like the versatility he's shown offensively as far as I can pick and pop, I can pick and roll, I can drive. I've really enjoyed what he's done for this team. Josh Hart, by the way.
Yes.
I think we need to give him a salute. He has been incredible. His defense, if you watch him, he's all over the place. Man, switched on a pick and roll, almost got a lob attempt, screen navigation. He's just a winner. He is a winner.
Also, hello, Bob Port, who is just sprinkling it in whenever he needs to. Some jumpers and post-ups. He's working defensively. It hasn't always been good, to be clear. But the effort has not wavered for Bobby Portis throughout this entire game stretch.
And then a quick shout out to Walker Kessler and the Gnosis for the beef that keeps giving.
I wasn't expecting beef stories with those two.
Also, they played twice, and every time they play, they try to dunk on each other's head, and I'm trying to figure out where this originated from.
can I be respectfully messy very, very, very briefly?
What's up?
Can we talk about that Walker Kessler jumper?
What? He caught it, faced up, said it's my time, and thing goes right.
What was that?
Hey, sometimes you got to be aggressive, and sometimes you end up doing the stanky leg. It's okay. Oh,
God. Yeah, that was an early release. He was not cooking. But anyway, thus concludes the Team USA thoughts. On the other side, or I guess technically close to home, question mark, Team Canada is just blazing through folks right now. Beat France by 30, which, brief aside, France being out already was not something that I had on my bingo card. We can talk about it. Beat France by 30, 95-65, then beat Lebanon, 128-73. Lebanon, excuse me.
I'm about to say, you about to get us banned.
Oh, God. I was like, wait a minute. It's 825. Like, that is not how you say that. We got it, though. But a 55-point victory in the second game. I've been very impressed with Canada's defense in all series. That level of, the level of ball pressure that you're seeing from the perimeter players from Team Canada, and then mixing in the scheme versatility from the bigs on top of that, it threw France for a loop. It just threw France for a loop. Which, first, quick shout out to Evan Fournier for the first half that he had at the very least. But, like, after that, they just didn't have much fun. A quick salute to Dylan Brooks in that game. Just Dylan Brooks, period, right now, for the defense that he's been playing. Proving that, you know, above all the conversation about him, etc., he made an all-defense team for a reason. He's really freaking good as a perimeter defender. And going to the other end of the floor, we haven't really seen the Dylan Brooks hijack so far. Now, it's been two games, so we'll see.
Dylan Brooks is just aggressive. And what I'd like to have happen in this world that we live in, take a second, you deliver your take, whatever, take a second to think about the possibility that you could be wrong. And so you can understand what's happening. Dylan Brooks is not just magically some bad basketball player. He's just a guy who will take some shots. And the more aggressive he is offensively, the more aggressive he is defensively. It's a package deal. And so, you know, you watch the Canada-France game, and I always joke with Rockets fans, are you ready for the Dylan Brooks experience? Because, hey, he came down early in the clock, took, I think, a pull-up three very quickly, and I was like, okay. Then the next time he got it, he turned the corner and dunked on someone, and it was like, yeah, this is what That's it what is. He can do. You are going to have to live with a couple of those. So now he's not hunting, and now he's just going to, okay, let me play. And then defensively, he's very good. I am so fatigued with the whole cycle of this player is slept on. This player's good. Ooh, I like this player. He's doing a lot. I don't know, man. Actually, might not be as good. Nah, he's bad. Nah, he's trash. Why do we do that? It's not analysis. If you want to tell me why you think he's not that good of a player, that's fine. But like just saying, oh, nope, he's done. It's over. No. I didn't mean to hijack your Dylan Brooks point, but I'm just...
No, you're fine.
It don't make no sense to me. Anyways, did you have more Canada thoughts?
I'm enjoying the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander experience. He's very good at basketball. Jumper seems smoother, which is a very fun development as we zoom out to like the NBA season coming up in a couple months. Wow, dude. But jumper seems smoother. The drives are still there. He's a little bit of everywhere defensively as well. He's just good. He's just good. It's going to be very... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought you were going to praise Canada's zone, or press to zone.
You do a podcast long enough with somebody. I thought, I was like, yeah, I'll leave it. I'm going to go with ball pressure and scheme versus tilt. But no, that's fun. That's... hey, man. You good luck. Good luck bringing the ball up the floor. They turn you over, then it's just cool. Also, like RJ trying to find it. You know, first game, we're like, second game, like, hey, here he is.
But to the Shai point, and you mentioned the smoothness of the jumper, the big key is that step back is going to cause some problems. Because of his ability to drive and the way that he drives in a straight line, as a defender, you're working to cut him off. And he's already going to that step back animation. And it's a close shot. It's a good shot. And he'll do it from three. That makes it tricky because of how good he is at driving. I think the bigs for Canada have been very fun. Dwight Powell showing, hey, I can do some hub adjacent things if you'd like.
International Kelly Olynyk.
Doing the thing. Lou Dort just comes in like a wrecking ball. I know, but shout out to Lou Dort. I think it was in the lead up to the World Cup. This man pulled the chair on a charge attempt, guys. We ain't talking about it on the pod, but that was one of the wildest things I've ever seen in my life. That man rotated, planted, and then leaned back like it was 2000 and whenever that song came out. And I was stunned. But no, Canada's serious. They should be enjoying their hoop.
So would that be Fat Lou, Fat Dort? How are we mixing the two? Because that also sounds slanderous, and I don't think that's how that works.
Dort Joe.
We'll run with it. We'll roll with it. All right, very briefly, mentioned it earlier, France is out after two straight losses. What happened? Was it just What happened?
Here was my thing with France. You mentioned Evan Fournier's first half performance against Canada. And then you realized how much they needed Evan Fournier to deliver that performance. And then it's like, oh no. If Nando DeColo and Evan Fournier were not doing things, where did they go? And did they post up Yabusele? I felt like Rudy was being used in a different way because usually this is the context where Rudy Gobert is very aggressive, but I felt like he was setting a lot of screens and I was like, wait, this ain't FIBA Rudy.
Yeah, I just didn't get the Rudy usage through two, and not like he was a world beater when he had the ball in his hands. So like that had to be at least part of it. But yeah, to your point, we just expect this is when he averages like 21 and 12. And it was very much just the Minnesota usage for him offense, which, yeah, it was the Minnesota usage for him offense. It's kind of tough. Also, shout out Nick Batum.
Can I be respectfully messy real quick?
Sure.
Is he going to hear that lyric in two languages?
Well, he won't be playing any more fourth quarters in this competition, so I guess probably not. Luka Doncic through two games, just very casual, 37-7-6-2-1 in the first game, and then put up 34-10-6-3 against Georgia. So it's the Luka experience in Slovenia, so that's cool. Also, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. What?
Hey.
He can hoop, but I wasn't expecting this particular brand of hooping. Like, I told a story in the watch party where I was like, was it the FIBA account that made like the Kobe tweet with him? And so I clicked on it. Well, first I just saw the thumbnail and the screenshot. I was like, yeah, surely y'all aren't saying he like looks like that's not how that works. That's a yellow flag. And so I click on the video and it's the announcer just saying Hollis Jefferson. In my mind, I was like, okay, who is Hollis Jefferson? I'm thinking like first name, last name. And I was like, wait, no, that's Rondae Hollis Jefferson. This man, he got the whole mid-range package going. We got some up and unders, got a nice dunk. We got some and ones. I was like, yo, he is taking over. This is fire. It's nice to see him hooping again. I miss him in the league, Loki.
I'm happy for Rondae because I feel like he had evolved. But he just couldn't find that landing spot. Because I felt like he was very good in that tweener big role. But it was kind of like he kind of got the Derrick Jones Jr. treatment. And then it was like, oh, well, we're just going to go somewhere else. And I kind of felt bad for him. Because he always had that drive. But the way that he's getting to his pull-up and the aggression that he's showing, the spins, it's nice to see him put it all together. I think that's part of the fun of basketball we miss out on sometimes. Because it's always, hey, you're good or you're bad. We got to watch these guys evolve and grow up and understand and figure these things out. I'm sure he had to look in the mirror at some point and be like, okay, where am I going with this? How good can I be? You know, the league can give you a whole bunch of opportunity. It can serve you some humble pie too. So it's nice to see him have this moment and have this kind of success on this stage.
Fire. Can we get Rondae and Charlotte?
How many Charlotte references are we going to get?
I'm just asking questions. All right. Any closing FIBA thoughts for you? Any players that stood out? Team doing a scheme thing that's been fun?
Karl Anthony Towns' work with the Dominican Republic has been fun. I believe they swept their group as of right now. I think they've gotten pretty creative at times with where he's catching it. And my eye goes to Minnesota in that context. And I've just been keeping an eye on Cat's drives. As we talked about with more FIBA, like even the switching take going to international play, where, hey, we're going to switch a guard on you. We're going to put this size on you. And the difference for Cat when he catches and closer to the basket and drives, as opposed to some of those, I'm at the 3-point line and now I'm going to drive. And can Minnesota use that to your advantage and tweak it? Because there were a couple fun elbow sets where they cleared out the left side, let Cat go to work. He had space and it's like, okay. Now you can set up jab, you can attack, you can initiate contact. It makes a lot more sense. The ones where he catches at the 3-point line and decides it's turbo button time. And it's almost like a 2K animation at this point. So where it's catch, quick go, bump, either you bump me or I bump you. Someone from the wing swipes down. So now I grab the ball. I got to maneuver it. Yeah. I no longer have my dribble. And we are going to 1-2 step into something.
You hear A, he does not get the call, and then it is, oh my God.
So if he can either get that, take his time, like he just looks like a different player, a different driver when he has that purpose and that patience. When it's just go, 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 now it's up to chance. And so I like kind of the work that he's putting in there.
Okay, that was the one for you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All good. That's all I had. So We can now shift to the W.
Yeah, we can, buddy. Yeah, we can, buddy. Yeah, we sure can, pal. We sure can.
We got Aces Liberty Part 78 on Monday night, which I guess technically the fifth matchup of the regular season, if you're including the Commissioner's Cup. The Liberty, 3-2 lead after last night's game. A 94-85 win, which represents the first single-digit win, but that wasn't really in earnest. Like, it was very much just Liberty by double digits for most of the, well, basically from the second quarter onward, felt like this is a double-digit game. So got a three very late from, I think, Sid Colson to bring it within single digits. But Liberty with a 9-point win. They are now a game and a half back of the Aces for the top seed. So that is getting interesting. The Aces with, I think, four games to go. Liberty with four or five games to go at this point. Sabrina Ionescu with 25. Stewie with a fourth quarter surge, which fun for her. Finishes with 20 points, 12 rebounds, 7 assists, 3 steals, and 2 blocks. Which that's also just kind of been the funny thing watching Stewie against the Aces this year. Because she just has not shot well against them. And I think generally the Aces have done a good job. But that's kind of been it, though. Like, I can't say that Stewie has had a bad game against the Aces this season. Because the defense has been phenomenal for her. And with the amount of doubles that the Aces send her way on some of those mid and post touches, she's still getting rid of the ball quickly, and the Liberty are able to play advantage basketball out of that. But it was nice to see her just have like a scoring surge late in that game. And it served as a reminder of like, oh, wait, this is someone that is very, very good that can throw any scheme thing that you try over the top rope. And so that was fun to watch. Courtney Vandersloot quietly with a big game, 17 points, 10 dimes, 5 boards, and a steal. Benaj Laney with 17, once again, got loose on some post-ups, cuts, made some timely shots as well. Asia with 23-8. Jackie Young with 24-4-5 with some buckets late. Hit a couple of big threes to kind of end up being like a fake comeback, but that was kind of teetering on, hey, wait a minute, the Aces might actually make this interesting as Jackie Young got going with a couple of pull-ups. And the guard play from the Aces beyond that, though, just kind of wasn't there. Chelsea Gray and Kelsey Plum combining for 25 points on 7 of 27 shooting. Aces typically just aren't going to win games like that, especially against a team as good as New York. Did have a combined 12 assists, but yeah. So those are your box score numbers of note. Steve, what were your impressions of this basketball?
I had quite a few, but I wanted to start because it's very interesting. The Aces are an extremely, extremely good team. Again, we're talking about the Comets. They've won, what, the most games in W history. I'm not going to tap the what's wrong with the Aces button. I do have a couple questions, but I'm not going to tap that button. The one thing that stood out to me before we dive into this game, I remember, I think we talked about it on the pod. I was reading the Liberty's game note, and they, like, built out their statistical profile for the year and compared it to so many teams. And that's where my head was like, if the Aces didn't exist, the Liberty would be talked about in such a different way, but the Aces do exist. So they're 28-7. They've won 18 of their last 21 games, Mikaias. Literally, since the June 29th loss to the Aces, they're 18-3. Kind of wild. I think the biggest thing, and it ties into this game, is how they built their team. With movement and defense, and now you're seeing the belief in it. Because I thought the Aces got off to a pretty solid start, a little uneven, but I thought they were good, but it didn't change how the Liberty played. And for me, what stood out is that the Liberty just looked comfortable on each end of the floor. And the interesting part about watching these teams play so many times in such a condensed time frame, you're starting to get the, well, if this team does this, that's their path to win. I don't know if the other team can. There were some plays that jumped out to me early. Aces started in zone. Liberty stuck with their ball move. Eventually got to Stewie, and they got a draw and kick. Sabrina, again, set the tone, I thought. Comes up tempo, quick pick and roll, missed the three, but okay, I'm here. Next pick and roll, she drives, engages the defense, kicks it to Stewie. Stewie misses, but hey, I'm here. And then Sabrina kept driving. I think she had a switch against Kia Stokes and looked to go and finish a layup. And I was like, oh, okay. Sabrina's driving early. I thought Courtney Vandersloot was much more decisive. I thought they looked for Jonquil a lot more when she had some of the matchups and some of the switching. I thought it was the Liberty's activity on defense. They were able to throw multiple schemes at the Aces, keep them out of rhythm, and they were able to rotate behind it. And that's always been their strength. You saw Jonquil at the level and dropping. You saw Jonquil switch every now and then. You saw Stewie at the level. You saw traps. You saw rotating behind it. Their guards were working really hard to keep the ball in front. And the one tweak that I noticed early, the Liberty were still showing help, but it was not as automatic as they had shown against the Aces before. So, and that was the key to the last Aces victory, because you saw them understand, okay, if I drive, someone's going to come help. We can go drive and kick and play out of that. Instead, activity, activity, their body's there, but they're not committing. And now you have to finish. Jackie Young knew the assignment early. He said, cool. Sabrina, let's go for a ride. But I think that lack of fully committing everyone to take away the paint may have thrown the Aces out a little bit. That defense is just so important. What were your takeaways about the Liberty defense?
My takeaway generally was the Liberty defense. Once again, like, just their growth from the beginning of the year to now has just been a joy to watch, honestly. I think in this particular game, you hit on it as your last point. That was going to be my first point. They had, and I made this comment in the watch party, it felt like they had Asia seeing Ghost in the first half. And this is with Asia still scoring at an efficient rate. But whenever Asia got a post touch in particular, first couple of touches swarm, immediate help. And then Asia get a touch and bodies are there, but there's no help coming. And after a couple more possessions of that, Asia would get a touch. Now, I remember there was a post up on the left side of the floor for her against Stewie, deep positioning. 99 out of 100 times that Asia gets that set up against literally anyone is a quick face up or a quick, you know, shoulder into the chest, turn around. She's getting to the rim or getting to the free throw line or both. Asia catches this single coverage on the left block, head, ball over her head, looking like, wait a minute, where's the help coming from? Where y'all coming from? What's going on? And by the time she turned back around to attack, the advantage felt gone. And the Liberty were able to just load up on it. And it turned into a kick. She gets it to Chelsea Gray. Chelsea Gray ends up taking a turnaround jumper over, I want to say it was Courtney Vandersloot. It was over Nigel Laney. Excuse me. She ends up taking a turnaround jumper, a very makeable shot for Chelsea Gray. She just didn't have it yesterday, so it missed. But I was like, that's the impact of the Liberty sending the help the way that they do. Because now it's in Asia's head. I need to see where this is coming from before I do anything. And that level of stagnation in combination with the Liberty already just kind of loading up their help. If Kia Stokes is on the floor, we're not guarding her. Alicia Clark, who has shot well from three pretty much all year up until this very recent stretch. So she's on the floor. She's in the corner. We're helping out for her. We are shrinking the floor. We're making everyone uncomfortable inside the arc. You add in indecisiveness on top of that, it becomes very tough for the Aces to function. And then you zoom out again, and it's Kelsey didn't shoot well. And ultimately, this felt like one of Kelsey's worst games of the season. Didn't shoot well, fouled out. Some of the shots that she did take were very early in the clock and out of flow. And it got to a point in the first half where I was like, hey, like, I know the Aces do their normal bit of staggering, and they mix some stuff up as of late as they played a little bit deeper in their bench. But I had the question, the thought bubble, like, do the Aces ever reach the point where they just can't have Asia and Chelsea off the floor at the same time? Because the offense just won't function the same without at least one of them. Because Asia's obviously the player that can draw two most consistently on the roster. And with Chelsea, even if she isn't drawing two and, you know, she's facing a team like the Liberty switched a ton, or just in general a team that will switch a bunch, like, Chelsea at the very least can win her own matchup and also can just navigate the pace of their offense and make sure that they get something up. Because watching Kelsey on the floor without Chelsea or Asia, a lot of quick shots and just some shaky decision-making overall, it just didn't feel good. And then you look at what the Liberty were able to do on the other end against Kelsey. And it wasn't just that they went after her. It was the multitude of ways that they went after her. Oh, you are guarding the ball. We are putting you in action in pick and roll. Oh, you are off the ball. You're on Benaja. She is just going to sink down and get a quick post seal. And we're going to force the Aces defense to react, or you are getting post up. Or as you fight, you're going to be called for another foul. I didn't like all the foul calls on Kelsey, but we're going after her. Oh, you're off ball. We're going to make sure Breonna Stewart screens for whoever you're guarding. You're going to switch on to her. And now we're going to play, do that whole song and dance once again and watch the Aces try to scram you out or watch you fight against a mismatch and we can play out of that. It just feels like there are some themes between these two teams that are kind of, kind of presenting themselves. It's just the general help that the Liberty show and just how aggressive they are in helping off of some of the shooters that they don't respect. And on the other end, it is very consistently turning into let's find Kelsey. Or at the very least, there's a comfort in knowing we can tap that button if our usual movement isn't working. And so, like, those were the kind of things that stood out to me early.
Oh, I mean, with Kelsey Plum, I think you got to take the good and the bad. You need her to stay aggressive. And she's obviously been aggressive in the matchup. If the bit is what happens when Kelsey Plum plays well, and can the Liberty handle that? That takes a lot off the table, no?
Yeah.
And so I thought Sloop did a good job of crowding space for the most part. And some of the pull-ups, they just didn't give a ton of space for that as well. But I think they need Kelsey to do Kelsey things. They need Jackie Young to also continue to elevate. So now, not only can we stagger, when we all come back together, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the issue was they didn't have all their guards in rhythm. And for me, I thought the Liberty showing different looks and their late help probably threw Kelsey off more than anticipated. I thought she had a couple good plays as far as, okay, I got a kick, I got a shot fake, I got a drive, but I'm now driving into three people. There's a person in front of me as opposed to this person helping early. And that's just kind of an adjustment that didn't take place. I got a question for you about the AC.
Okay.
And mainly for me with the Aces, it just felt like the tempo was just a little bit off to start. Like the hitch in the offense was there. How do you feel about the trap that the Liberty threw at the Aces? And I mentioned that. Hey, Chelsea Gray, we're going to heat you up real quick. Hey, Jackie Young, we're going to go under, and then we're going to trap real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Kelsey, hey, we up here as well, too. My mind also goes back to that Sparks game, and they just said, nope.
Yeah.
Two on the ball. And then my mind went to that Mystics game and some of the plays where Shakira Austin would be in a drop. Penetration would be there, and then Shakira was like, cool, late switch, now what? In my mind, even bigger than this particular game, it feels to a degree teams are trying to decide which poison they're going to take. We're going to live with this, but we're taking this away. And I think it's less, I'm trying to figure out how to say it, but it feels like taking an incredible offense, an incredibly talented team, and trying to get them to live in a box. Like, this is where you stay. This right here. How do you feel about some of those stretches or how they're dealing with activity?
Well, I think that's been, as we've talked through it on the pod and also just in our watch parties when we were watching the Aces or whatever, I feel like the two things that I've kind of keyed in scheme-wise with the Aces, like defensively, what are they doing against empty side pick and roll? And offensively, what are the guards doing against pressure? And more specifically, like what are Jackie and Kelsey doing against whenever they see that pressure? Because I think Chelsea can just handle anything. And so I worry less about her. And I worry more about like, okay, what does it mean if the ball just isn't in Chelsea's hand? More so like, oh no, they're turning Chelsea over. She's out of rhythm. I think Chelsea's just good enough and stable enough. She can just find her own. Like even some of the ISO drives yesterday against the Liberty. I feel like she has as much as you can because Benaja's really good. To the degree that you can figure out a Benaja Lady matchup, I feel like Chelsea's kind of figured out how to get to her spots against Benaja now. Whereas the early, maybe not the win early, but like since that second game onward, it's kind of felt like, oh, Benaja's bothering her. And she may score, but she's having to work really hard. It feels like Chelsea's kind of figured out how to go about it. And it's more of a make or miss ordeal versus Benaja throwing out of rhythm. But yeah, like Kelsey versus Hedges or Kelsey versus Traps was something that we were talking about on the pod last year. And like Jackie just didn't see much of that last season. But because she has elevated to this degree offensively, which is, again, a testament to how good she's been, now she's starting to see, okay, it's not an under anymore. We're going over, but we're showing some early help. we're going over the bigs plan to drop a little bit higher now. And so now this is an adjustment period for Jackie Young, which, again, it's an overall positive. It is good that she is drawing more attention, but now she has to sort through that. And so zooming out team-wide, and this was something that I wanted to ask Becky post-game, but it became very apparent early that it wasn't the time slash the mood to ask that kind of question. Because Becky has been, let's say, less than enthused about the scheduling for the Aces as of week, as she has noted multiple times. 11 games in 23 days, whole lot of travel, etc. Two references in two games that she considered resting her starters before ultimately being overruled by her players, which that's a whole nother conversation. But yeah, I was like, I had a question in my mind, like, hey, do you feel like there's a theme establishing itself about how teams want to guard y'all in terms of helping off the non-shooter? Not that it's like sciences level stuff or anything like that, but in terms of how aggressive they are with shrinking the floor or how consistent they are in trapping these particular players and making them sort through. And so maybe that's something I ask because I think today's going to be the travel day. Tomorrow, they're probably going to have practice. And then the next game is on Thursday for them. So maybe that's something I try to sprinkle in if I can in the Zoom availability or something. But yeah, like it feels like trap Kelsey is the way to go right now. Just to be frank about it, because it isn't something that she's handled well consistently. We have seen the games where she's been able to drive past it, or when she's been able to get off of it early and the Aces have been able to play advantage from there. But on a possession by possession basis, I think defenses can feel good knowing we can throw a hint. We can make them hitch. We can throw them off rhythm if we do this. Showed itself in the Sparks game, definitely showed itself in this one, and something that I noted in the watch party as well. I appreciated the nuance in which the Liberty sprinkled in those traps. It wasn't an automatic. With Stewie getting the Asia matchup, if Chelsea Green was operating pick and roll with Asia, we are putting two on the ball. Not you. We're going to make y'all play out of it. If it's Jackie, here's a drop. Might be a little bit higher, might be a little bit lower, but here's a drop. If it's Kelsey, nah, not you. And just having that level of nuance to know what threats are, how we want to deal with this. Like, it was really impressive stuff for the Liberty. But going back to the Aces point, yeah. Like, I think that's something that they absolutely have the talent and the ability to figure out. And I don't know how many non-Liberty teams can pull this off. You know, have the duel of we can apply this pressure defensively, throw them off rhythm, and also score enough. Like, the Liberty may just be the team that can do that in a playoff setting. But as far as like a template establishing itself, like I feel like that's happening. I'm kind of with you on that.
No, I think it's interesting. I think the point you made about the different schemes, that's the toughest part, I think, for the Aces. And to me, it applies more to this particular matchup just because of the tempo the Liberty play with, which can suck you into some quicker shots as opposed to, hey, we're going to put pressure on your defense. Thought that the Aces got away from that a little bit. So I just wonder how many teams are going to be able to toggle through that and also still have the offensive firepower, you know, because it's one thing to work to try and stop them, but then you also have to score. Like, that was the one thing about the Mystics game. It's like, y'all working defensively, but also
this final score though.
Can you keep doing the other thing or else you're going to waste that work? So it's interesting. I do want to say Bonnie Jelani,
she's so good,
deserves more credit and respect. I don't know if it bothered Chelsea Gray. I don't think it did. But she was working her tail off. Pressure him, not getting screened. And I say it, I don't think it bothered because I remember Chelsea, like, Banaja had an incredible defensive sequence where, hey, I'm pressuring, I'm active, I'm over the screen, I'm in front of you. And Chelsea Gray was like, sweet, here's a behind-the-back pass to Kayla George. And I was like, okay, so it's a give and take here. But her defense has been incredible. And then the offense, the way that they've continued to use her, the post-ups for Bonnie Jelani, one, it keeps her involved in a threat. Two, Nikias, they are running stuff off of it. They are, you know, we've seen them run a stagger last night in that game. They're running post splits for Stewie into a handoff for Stewie. So now you end up helping and it's a kick to Sabrina for three. Kind of tough. And also, I think a smidge more respect needs to be put on Sabrina's name.
Yeah.
Hey, listener who's upset with me for saying that, Give me the list of folks averaging 17 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists in the W this year.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, again, a quiet subplot of these Aces Liberty matchups. The first game, the Aces blew the Liberty out of the water. When's the last time Sabrina felt like a liability defensively in this matchup?
The first quarter.
That's just kind of been it for like 3-4 games, though.
Yeah. No. I mean, she's working. She is giving her all. I will say that much. There, go back and watch that game. The hands are up, and
not me.
feet, please keep moving.
But no, like I think her growth defensively this year has kind of gone under the radar because she's still, like, she's very much sub elite. Nobody should be making that kind of leap. But something that you've talked about consistently is like working to get out of the liability zone. And I feel like Sabrina, for the most part, has done that. Like some of that is just having a lesser offensive load than she had last year or the last couple of years. And so she's able to exert more. A lot of it is the infrastructure that she's in now. Like, okay, cool. I'm going to continue to work and improve my effort and try to improve the angles that I take, et cetera. But I got Jonquil behind me. I got Stewie behind me. I got Benaja pressuring. Like, the job is easier for her, but she is doing her job. She's doing her best to stay in front. Like, it is both a testament and a little bit of an indictment for the Aces. But it's a testament that the Liberty can just say, hey, no, you guard Jackie Young. And we trust that we're not going to be in rotation a bunch. That is not something that they could have did comfortably last season. That wasn't something they could have did comfortably in the first matchup of the year between these two teams. So, like, just seeing that growth, and again, like, her navigating the switches and being quick to get out when they're trying to scram her out and finding her matchup without it becoming a breakdown elsewhere. Like, it's little stuff, and it doesn't end in Sabrina has 3 steals and a block or something like that. But her being solid within the team's concept has been very important for the Liberty. And then you go to the other end and you see the pressure that she puts on defenses with the pull up, the passes that she can make, not just the passes that she can make on the move, but making the passes and then relocating and finding space the way that she does on that 3 that you referenced where they're running the post split from Benaja and Stewie's kicking. Like Sabrina was just stashed deep in the right corner. And as the drive happens, quickly darts up to the wing to make the rotation even tougher for the Aces and then gets a 3. And it's just like, it's small stuff, but it's stuff that she just nails. It knows how to navigate that space off the ball. It's really impressive. So her being able to blend in the on-ball and the off-ball nuance and hold serve defensively, which is all she has to do. Hold serve defensively. It's led to this. Like, I'm starting to reconfigure my all-W second team at this rate. So Sabrina was on my honorable mention list when we talked about this, week and a half ago at this rate. Those are the seasons. She's probably going to wind up on my second team. She's been very good. And again, we'll note, she is in the midst of literally the best high volume 3-point shooting season in WNBA history. She's good. She's really good.
She is. And honestly, the fun part of Aces Liberty is these two teams are so good and they put so much pressure on each other. We've seen the Aces make the Liberty react and rotate. We saw the Liberty do it. Honestly, that when Stephanie Dolson did not hesitate to take an open 3, I was like, oh, they're locked in. All right. So we'll see if we get that matchup in the finals, because I don't know what's going to happen in these playoffs. We got a stretch of games down the stretch of, my goodness, what is happening. One of you good teams gets your reward to be the Washington Mystics. Just have fun with that.
Yeah. As they finally get healthy. Ooh, boy. Ooh,
Sparks.
Boy.
The Sparks going to be the 7th seed.
Hey, man. At this rate, look. I guess we can actually, before we transition to the last major W topic that I had on the doc, Kayla George, Jonquil Jones thoughts on whatever that was.
There's a little sauce on there. I still maintain, I think Kayla anticipated Jonquil to turn the other way, which would enhance the contact. Fortunately, Jonquil just released and it looked a little hazy.
Uh-oh, y'all. Oh, goodness. Honestly, man, I don't... Ooh, boy. Also, just a very general, I'll zoom out from the Aces Liberty game. Like, I had some thoughts on that game in particular watching yesterday, but just over the last few games that I've watched on the W side, I am going to echo the sentiments of many a player this season at this rate. I have not enjoyed the officiating as of late.
Oh.
I have not. It just feels like it fluctuates between we are allowing all of the contact to, hey, did you just sneeze in the general direction of a player? This is a whistle. And everyone is confused, including me as a viewer. If the game's going to be called tight, call it tight all the way. If you're going to let them play, let them play all the way. The fluctuation in what's allowed and what isn't is just very odd. And it makes for a lot of frustration as, you know, Sasha Cloud has said stuff. Jewel Lloyd has said stuff. Like, it's been a league-wide thing. And it is upsetting to me and my pals. So, I will sprinkle that in. Also on the storm front, and then we can get to some dream talk. I'm still very confused at what happened at the end of the latest Storm game. Seattle down 5. The ball finds Jordan Horston. Chicago's just not playing defense. And Jordan Horston's like, oh, they're not playing defense. I guess we're done here. And Jewel Lloyd is on the opposite end of the court. Like, what are you doing? And I don't know what to make of that. And had I seen that live, I would have hopped into Zoom to ask about it. To my dismay, it was just not asked about post game either, so we just don't know what happened there. But yeah, it's been some interesting stuff.
Nikias, talk about how that made you feel.
Oh, God, don't get me started on the talk about dog. So
thoughts?
Bad. It's thoughts. It's so bad. My thought is that talk abouts are bad. Ask a question.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Nikias. Could you please talk about?
Anyway, I tell you what I can talk about, Steve. Let's talk about the Atlanta Dream, who have dropped their last two in less than spectacular fashion. Had a lead late against the Sparks. Offense dies with a mix of bad shots and turnovers. Tanisha Wright post-game is like, hey, Sparks had a plan. They fed NECA, and she came through. My all-stars didn't rise to the occasion. Ooh. Okay, hold the stars accountable. I feel you. Talks about the lack of attention to detail, the lack of pace, how they're walking through sets, etc. And I guess the line that caught a lot of people on social media was like, this team needs to grow up. It's playoff time. These are what all these games are going to be like. This team has to grow up. I was like, ooh, that's basketball level scathing from your head coach after a tough loss. So then the Atlanta Dream play the Indiana Fever, who, as of today, still technically aren't eliminated from playoff contention. So we'll keep an eye on that, I suppose. And the Atlanta Dream go up 8 with like 2:07 left. Ryan Howard hits 3 free throws. They're up 8 with 2:07. Aaliyah Boston is not on the floor for the Indiana Fever fourth quarter. She basically just does not play most of the fourth quarter. And the Dream blow the game. The Fever snatched it, so I don't want to completely remove praise from them. But the Dream completely blow it with, again, a mix of turnovers and bad shot selection. And I caught the fourth quarter that we went back and watched, and then this morning before the pod, I went back and watched like that fourth quarter stretch again. And I still find myself confused at the sequence of events for the Atlanta Dream. So after the Ryan free throw, they inbound the ball to Cheyenne Parker. She immediately takes a 3 and misses. Ball goes off the left side of the rim. Dream able to maintain possession because the Fever can't hold it. They run an elevator set from the baseline for Ryan Howard. She misses a 3. Next possession down, gets a drop, post touch for Cheyenne Parker. She draws a double team, gives it to Nas Hillman. She turns it over. Next possession, Ari McDonald, she drives, she misses a close shot, couldn't get it to go. The Fever at this point making their run. Emma Cannon and one, Big Shot Christy Wallace, etc. After a make, the Fever try to press. Alicia Gray takes a layup with 17 on the shot clock and misses. And on the other end, you get a Christy Wallace. And it's just like, I don't know, because there's been like rumblings about like the coaching, and there are things to critique with Tanisha Wright. But I look at that closing stretch, and I also look at how they closed that Sparks game, and I'm just like, okay, what exactly do we want Tanisha Wright to do with some of this stuff? Like, I don't know what you do with that. And I think those kind of instances is where she's referencing that the team has to grow up. And I think it's more of, I shouldn't have to tell you to do these things or not to do these things. And again, I keep going back to that Cheyenne Parker three right after the Ryan free throws. This is like, that wasn't the play call. Like, they literally just inbound to her, I think, to set up what they wanted to run. And Cheyenne saw her defender was sagging off because, yes, you sag off of Cheyenne Parker at the three-point line. And she just flings it. And it's just like, why are we looking for the dagger with 2 minutes left? Like, run the offense. I don't think that's on Tanisha. And I think the frustration that's baked in is something that we've talked about with this dream team is that there are just some structural stuff that can't really be addressed until the offseason. Like, I think they are generally just an advantage creator short on the perimeter to really unlock everything that they want to do. And I think they wanted Ari to make that step to be that kind of third advantage creator behind Ryan and Alicia. And Aerie's been hurt most of the year, and they've been trying to work her back in. And so teams can have a level of comfort of switching and throwing things off, and that's where they need to run everything with a purpose. They have to screen hard. They have to cut hard. They have to play with a tempo in the half court. And these are things that teams should hammer home. And when they don't do that, the offense doesn't flow. And when the offense doesn't flow, they can't set their defense, and the defense doesn't look good either. And it just kind of snowballs from there. And so, as a coach, generally, you just want maximum effort because you want maximum effort. You want the attention to detail. There, because of where the how the roster is made, like, they also just can't afford to have slippage. And for them to have the kind of slippage that they have late in games, it's rough. It is rough.
They need to grow up. They need to learn how to win, is how I took that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you got to remember, this Atlanta Dream team, as talented as they are, as much as they've cleaned up, they still have to learn how to win. This is a very, very, very competitive league. If we had a producer and a soundboard, I would ask for my Atlanta Dream take to pop back up. And I would ask you, has anything changed? Do they have an identity? Is the defense at a level that will sustain some of the offensive issues? Has the tempo changed? Are they moving the ball? Who's creating opportunities? Who's hitting threes? What is behind your top three players playing well? And something stuck out to me. Here's the issue for Atlanta, and probably some of the frustration with that rant. This is 2 years of the same thing. You go back to July 3rd last year, they beat Seattle. They're 10-11. They finished 14-22. They went, what's that quick math, 4-11 down the stretch?
Mm-hmm.
July 18th, they beat the Minnesota Lynx this year to go to 12-8. They've gone 4-11 since. It's the same stretch with a different team. And you were supposed to be better. And you're supposed to have the type of players that can sustain you in the half court. The issue is you have now shifted where they have to sustain you. There's nothing behind that. If you contrast these two teams, that pace and tempo the Dream played with last year was incredible. It was incredible. It put so much pressure on teams. League kind of figured it out. Didn't necessarily have all the horses you needed. We're good. This year, got more talent to a degree on the high end. Feel better about what you're doing. Tempo's gone. Pace is gone. Scoring's there. Ryan Howard figured it out. Alicia Gray figured it out. Cheyenne Park figured it out. What's behind it? Is your defense going to be a calling card? It's playoff winning time. And in the month of August, you have a loss to the Phoenix Mercury, the Seattle Storm, the Sparks again in the Indiana Fever, you cannot lose to the team that's chasing you, and you can't have those type of performances against the teams that are already looking towards next year to a degree. In a span of 17 days, you probably should not blow a lead to the Seattle Storm and the Indiana Fever. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be mean. But until they, as a group, understand how they win, what their success is, they won't be able to finish. This league is too good. This league is too talented. It's too competitive. You have to have an edge to you because everyone's fighting and competing. In a vacuum, are the Lynx better than the Dream?
No, I don't think so. They shouldn't be at the very least. I put it that way.
What's the difference? In a vacuum, with the Mystics injuries, are they better than the Dream?
With their injuries, like, probably not. Like, again, they are getting healthier, like EDE's back and stuff. So it's probably just a yes at this point. But yeah, to that point.
Why are those two teams ahead of them?
Well, on the statistical front, post All-Star break, the Atlanta Dream easily have the worst offense in basketball. A 95.6 offensive rating. 11th, the Washington Mystics at 97.2. At 10th, the Seattle Storm at 98.2. At 9th, the Phoenix Mercury also at 98.2. At 8th, the Minnesota Lynx at 100.2. It's just, if you're almost 5 points worse than the Lynx, who have also missed Nafisa Collier in that stretch for a little bit of time. Like, it's... He missed some time for Minnesota. The Mercury have basically just played post-All-Star break without Diana Taurasi and Brittany Griner at this point. The Seattle Storm have been a bad offense for most of the year. Like, it's Jewel, help. Sammy, thanks for coming. And... we'll see what else we get. Well, Ezzy's also, he's having a good offensive season. I don't want to sleep on Ezzy. He's been fun. But it's just like, offensively, like, it's not great in Seattle. Washington, we just mentioned, they've been missing pieces all year long. We've been talking about the shooting and spacing all year long, even when healthy. All outperforming the Atlanta Dream offensively. Which I'll also shoot them a little bit of bail. Like, Ryan had the facial injury. Alicia Gray missed a couple as well. There was the right after All-Star break stuff from Cheyenne, which, okay, wasn't starting. It wasn't playing that much and then got back in and had to find a rhythm and stuff like that. But it's just like, conceptually, it's just been rough. Actually, beyond rough, it's just been frustrating. Because it'd be one thing if they were just bad and you just come in like, all right, bet they just can't do this. Like, with, you know, again, like, the Storm. Like, there's a general, like, talent deficit offensively. And you understand, if Jewel doesn't have it, it's just going to be really tough. This shouldn't be the case for Atlanta. You have the post hub in Cheyenne. You have Ryan that can operate on or off ball. You have Alicia that can operate on or off ball. In theory, you have Ari that can be an advantage maintainer for you. AD Durr that can create some shots off the bench for you. You have posts that can at least showcase a little bit of comfort inside of 16 feet. Either with putbacks, quick post-ups against smaller players, short mid-range jumpers, etc. You have enough to have, at worst, an average offense. That Atlanta is, like, easily 12th post-All-Star break. And 5-11 since the break. Like, it's just, can't have it. Can't have it. And now we look at the standings, and it's gone from, okay, Atlanta's kind of firmly the four seed to they are two games ahead of the 9th-ranked Chicago Sky. And again, I'm driving down to Atlanta today, so I'm going to catch Dream Mercury, and I don't know what to expect.
In hindsight, should we have recorded this after you returned?
No, it's fine, because like, I think it just needs to be said, because like... because like, if the Dream take care of business against the Mercury, who's probably gonna be missing Diana and BG, they should. That should be baked in. And the fact that it isn't just baked in is part of the issue that I have. Because as you noted, they have blown team, they've blown games to teams that they just should not have. They've lost to the Mercury in the stretch. Granted, that was the Diana game. Like, a little bit of veil there. But, hey, man. I want it for the dream. And you do kind of have to take a step back. Like, okay, this is year two of this. But also, like, I'm not asking for contention for the Atlanta this year. I didn't expect that. I was high on them coming into the year. I think I had them third in my preseason rankings or something like that. I expected them to be very good in the regular season. Like, I still didn't anticipate, like, contention. Win a round, be competitive in the second round, then you make your next jump next. It's kind of how I viewed them. And I'm looking at how they've closed this season. It's like, okay, who's going to be there next year? Because if I remember correctly, Tanisha Wright just signed an extension back in December. And so unless there's just some, like, locker room stuff in which, like, Ryan is upset or Alicia's upset. Now, I'm not reporting anything. I don't have sources on that front. But I'm saying unless it's something like that that we don't know about, Tanisha's probably going to be there. But I think heading into the year three of this thing, regardless of how the season ends, it just kind of turns into, okay, what do we need on this roster? How can we loosen things up for this offense for real and do so consistently? I think that's kind of where I'm at. Whew. Well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? the Dream do close their schedule with, again, the Phoenix game later today, on the road against Minnesota, at home against Seattle, on the road against Washington, and then at home against Dallas. Like, in theory, that should be 3-2? But, like, I don't...
The bigger issue for me is look at where you may potentially land. Yeah. Like, you were in the driver's seat for 5 and got an opportunity to win a series. Now we can see what we're made of, play with a little house money. You fall down to playing one of those top 2 teams in the first round, that's a different vibe. So can they look themselves in the mirror and find a way to finish this season strong, tap back into some of the success they've had? Or is this just going to be the ceiling for that group?
Which, you know what this means? They're just going to slide to 8, and it's just going to be a 3-game series with the Aces. Because the Aces are the good team that they have played well all year. And that's just going to be the competitive series. With Becky Hammon, I think, post-game, well, that last Atlanta game, saying, like, this team scares me a little. Which, testament to how talented the Dream are when they're firing, but also... Anyway, we'll close with one mailbag question since we're a little deeper into it than I thought we were going to be. Well, thank you to those who send in questions. Continue to send them in. There we go.
Did you just ask for food?
I'm on the Steve plan right now. I got to get breakfast before I hit the road. but no, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com if you have basketball questions for us on the NBA or W side or just general philosophy stuff. We really enjoy when y'all send them in. But we will go with this one from Michael, who asked, when it comes to scheme and play design, are there any concepts you see in the WNBA that you'd like to see NBA teams utilize more often? And on the flip side, are there anything NBA teams are doing that you'd like to see WNBA teams try more?
I mean, it's an interesting question because both leagues are evolving. I think, like, it's tough because there are way more unders in the W mm-hmm. than in the NBA right now. For the NBA, I probably like to see some more of the low in the half court, especially with some of the top teams where they just naturally will cut in space and do off-ball movement. Sometimes that has to be scripted in the league, mm-hmm. but I'd like some of that side-to-side pressure. In the W, I'd like to see ways that they can punish teams for putting 2 on the ball. And we mentioned the Aces, but also for the Wings to have Arike playing at this level and the bigs they have and to not be able to just absolutely make teams feel pain every single night. That's where I'd like to see some of the evolution with misdirection into a pick and roll, get the trap, open things up, that kind of thing. What say you?
I think for me, I go to defense, honestly. I think what I appreciate with the W compared to the NBA side anyway, it feels like more teams are willing to put two on the ball and just play pick and rolls a little bit higher. And so, like, I would like to see a little bit more crossover on that front of the NBA. I understand why it's more switching on the NBA side, though.
You talking about traps?
Yeah.
You Jim Boylan now?
No, I'm not. Don't do this. Don't do this. I think on the NBA side, I guess it's less like, I guess it's more scheme, less play design. I guess I would just like the ball screen to be set higher on the floor. Like, I don't think we've reached the full, like, NBA level shooting boom yet. But I do think there's more pressure that could be put. Like, I think of some of the high ball screens that the Liberty in particular was set for Sabrina. Like, I think more teams can afford to set them high on the floor. Because even with the Aces, like, they don't typically set them super high. Like, they'll get to some of their double drag stuff or some of their get action, and that's a little bit higher above the break. But generally, like, it's a lot of wing and lower pick and rolls for them. And, like, they're, again, heading into this weekend, you know, the Mystics game, the Liberty game, they were the best offense in W history. And so it's not like it's affected them, but I guess just more strain on defense from where they're starting their actions, I think, would be kind of that crossover. Those would be my early answers where I was called Najem Boylan. I didn't have that on the
bingo. It's more Naboylan Duncan.
Naboylan Duncan. Okay, fair enough. Do you have free throws? I do not. Naboylan Duncan. I started.
More shocking, how mobile phones are smuggled in or Mark Schindler getting packed up by French TMZ.
Oh, God. The answer is yes. But no, I just didn't have the cell phone thing. I was like, what? How? Because, like, when I saw the video, it's like, I guess it's a Coke bottle, but I guess it isn't a Coke bottle. I don't know. Anyway, I look at that. I'm just like, how the heck did they get a phone in it? Like, did they cut the top open and then, like, paste the thing? And it's like, open the middle of the thing. I was like, how the heck did they come up with this? It, as you see, I've just never smuggled anything. So I don't know the lore, I guess.
A kind-hearted young man, at Nikias. More likely purchase for Nikias Duncan, a Marcus Mariota Eagles jersey or a Philadelphia Eagles championship belt?
Can I be honest?
Yes.
It's the belt. it's just the belt. Look, man.
Come on, man. Leave my guy alone, man.
Nah, he needs to leave me alone. That man needs to learn how to throw the darn football. That's crazy.
Hey, I better not see no little bird app messages about that 4-yard scramble.
Yeah,
it's coming.
I'm sorry, it's 40-yard. What now?
Okay.
I rest my case.
All right. Is Julius Randle more like Jalen Brunson, or is Jalen Brunson more like Julius Randle?
Goodness gracious. The answer is yes. Again, another reason why y'all should just be in the dunker spot watch parties. Yeah, Jalen just being 6'1 Julius Randle is a funny concept. I guess Jalen is more like Julius. Like, there are just fewer guards that can deal with that kind of post play in inside the arc craft than fours, I guess.
Be honest, who was the funniest player you saw respond to the world champion debate?
Brother, all due respect, it is Denzel Valentine. Cause it was like KD and it was like star Denzel Valentine. And I was like, okay, hold on. Hold on. And I say that purely for joking purposes. Like, obviously, you have a license to laugh and comment on it. I don't think I need to put that disclaimer out there, but yeah. But that one did make me raise the brow a little bit.
Gotcha. Dwight Howard has a customized Rolls Royce that starts with his championship ring touches the trophy ornament. Is that the most Dwight Howard thing ever?
That's fire. I ain't gonna hold you.
All right.
You gotta. I gotta give it to him, man. That man got a ring as a key contributor to a title thing. Like, give it to him. I want Dwight to be able to enjoy his winning. That man's been slandered basically his whole career.
Good for you. Which Clay clip is going to be used more responsibly? Him answering the phone or him counting his fingers?
More responsibly? More responsibly is probably him counting the counting. Because I don't think the other one's going to be.
Okay. Would you listen to a Brandon Ingram and Walker Kessler podcast?
Probably. I'd give it a couple episodes.
Would you listen to a Kawhi Leonard and Bobby podcast?
I test it out. Like her trying to do the bit to Kawhi and Kawhi just like, no, that's just my answer. Yeah. I feel like she would be unnerved very quickly. Like, oh, wait, this is. No, he lives in this. It's like the Bane Batman scene. Like, oh, you think darkness is your. Like, nah, this is just what I do.
Have you ever achieved a level of patience and annoyance that Bob Barker had with that one contestant?
That man described what the game was and how to put them numbers together for that price like 7 different times, dog. And she kept writing these stuff. She kept writing the one twice. And it's like, you can't use the- Oh my goodness. Like, that's not funny, but oh my. That man was fed up.
Shout out Bob Barker, man.
Rest in peace, man.
More committed. Who's more committed? I'll ask you this. Frame it this way. You to getting rid of talk about questions or the legendary Chicago main punk to mess?
Is this a safe space?
Yeah. I mean, it's not.
It's not. I guess. I think it's me because like, I'm taking accountability for my push. I am actively trying to change something, and I think
All right, final one for you: a goatee Irving or Normie Nixing?
Who? I need the background on this one. Wait a minute.
Kyrie got a cut, and he got a goatee now. So is he goatee Irving or is he Normie Nixing? Because he looks like Norm Nixon.
Him just becoming better Dinwiddie is just not something I had on my bingo card, dog.
All right.
Normie Nixon is insane. But okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having some fun conversations in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. We're watching W basketball because naturally that's in season. We're watching FIBA hoops because naturally that tournament's going on right now. We're also watching a little bit of everything else. Some tennis. Some golf. We watched kickball not too long ago. Steve sprinkled in the Bachelorette. We watch wrestling. Mm-hmm. We go to YouTube sometimes and watch old wrestling promos. And Bret Hart is yelling at everyone. And the Buster podcast. You know, the I am a car. I don't know. We do a little bit of everything. So if you want to rock with us, enjoy whatever we put on screen and have some fun conversations. The link to the Dunker Spot watch party room is in your description. It should be hyperlinked. So just click on that, enter your information. It is free. No shenanigans. If not, you just copy and paste the link into your browser. Once again, enter your information. It is free with no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Yowie wowie.